Get energized and excited to tell the world, hey, you can call me Catholic. Live from the Christ Cathedral Campus in Garden Grove, California, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Orange County Catholic Radio present Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, well, for goodness sakes, pay attention to these things and think about them. That's direction straight from St. Paul to the Philippians. And from there, we can then talk about these good things, too. That's what we do on Call Me Catholic. Wish we had St. Paul here to join the conversation with us, but he's with us in spirit, surely. And we've got Jimmy G, my engineer-in-chief fact-checker. He's always here to add a little bit of texture to the conversation.
Hello there, Peggy. Great to be here today.
Your voice adds texture just unto itself, without the content even.
Well, I use my radio voice.
When people come in, when our guests come into the studio, they always say, wow, that's a great voice. It's like, hey, wait. What about over here? I'm the host.
It's not my regular voice. It's my radio voice.
No, you've got a great voice. And as we've mentioned to our listeners before, you actually have a professional background in voiceover and radio broadcast. So
a little bit. Yeah.
So we are in good company here, kids. Jimmy G and I are coming to you from high atop the Tower of Hope on the shimmering Christ Cathedral campus in Orange County, California. If you're driving through the area on vacation, maybe you're on your way to Disneyland or to the Big Red A at Angel Stadium, you can see our bright high-rise buildings from the freeway. So if you can't stop by for a tour of the campus, which is always a good idea, at least wave as you go by.
And the building we're in is truly iconic. It was the tallest building in Orange County for many years. It's got a cross on top.
A large cross on top.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful, there's lots to see, lots of beautiful historic buildings on this campus. So definitely try on your next visit to Southern California to include us in your itinerary. And if you can't wave to us on the freeway, wave to us on our Facebook page. Give us a little wave, a like, so to speak, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/callmecatholic. We post pictures and podcasts and links and likes, facebook.com/callmecatholic. And if you have ideas that you'd like to share for future shows, if you think, yeah, I'd really like to have a show on architecture. I'd really like to have a show on holy cards. I mean, we'll talk about anything on Call Me Catholic. We like to keep it interesting, and we like your input. So that's a good resource for you to list it for us.
We've even done live cooking demonstrations before.
Sure. Yeah. We have our smell-o-vision engaged for that one. Yeah. No, we like to keep it interesting, and we try to match up a good topic with a good guest who has good knowledge in that area. Now, my husband is a great resource for me in terms of coming up with show ideas because he is a newspaper junkie. Mm. He gets three newspapers every day, and I don't have time to read all of them. So he's my clipping service. He comes in and kind of puts one on my desk or folds the paper. So the other day he dropped one on my desk, and it was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal by a man who was kind of advocating that St. Thomas More's daughter, Margaret, should be considered for canonization. I mean, her father was, but she was a great social and, I mean, spiritual anchor for her father through the trials that he had. And she went on to lead a holy life. And so this man put forth that she should be considered too. There's certainly a lot of letters that document their relationship. So I thought that was very interesting, and I kind of put it aside. And then I went to my next source for, another source for show ideas, my book, My Calendar of Saints. And I noticed that tomorrow, July 9th, is the feast day for St. Thomas More. Now, so I'm thinking, bingo, I've got this article, I've got this date, I'm going to do a show on St. Thomas More. Now, I also, in looking through the calendar, I discovered that he's also listed as having a feast day on June 22nd.
Hmm.
So that's considered the newer feast day, and July 9th is kind of the historic feast day. And I'm kind of an old school gal, so I'm going with the July 9th one. And at any rate, between those two dates, it's a good season to talk about a great man for all seasons, St. Thomas More. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I was very, very fortunate to have access to a local scholar. He calls himself a student compared to us, Jimmy G. He's a scholar on this St. Thomas More. Someone who is committed to perpetuating his vast legacy. Greg Weiler is a practicing attorney here in Southern California. He's also something of a Catholic activist. A strong advocate for the pro-life movement. He helps the homeless. He serves on the board of directors of the St. Thomas More Society, one of the most successful Catholic lawyer associations in the country, bringing some Catholic sensibility and morality to the practice of law. He's going to be up in just a minute. But first, as you know, it's always time at the top of the hour to do our Call Me Catholic countdown, which this week is going to be my selection of the top five institutions named after St. Thomas More. Now, we are, I got to do a little soapbox here. We are surrounded by things, places, and buildings, organizations that have been named for saints. Mm-hmm. Something as common as St. Joseph Aspirin, San Antonio Winery, St. Andrew's Golf Course, St. Patrick's Day.
So many streets.
I can't even begin to recount the streets and cities of Southern California that are named for saints. San Diego, Santa Monica, San Fernando, mm-hmm. San Gabriel. But how often do we stop and consider the origin of the namesake? Who that saint was and why someone bothered to honor their life by naming a city or a hospital or a golf course after them. So, turns out St. Thomas More has quite a few institutions named after him, usually because he had a direct impact on the work and ethics of the business going on in that place. But let's explore five of those institutions. Now, I call them institutions because an institution can be a place or an organization. Gives me a little more freedom.
Or a golf course.
Or a golf, definitely. I hit the institution after I play golf, actually. I'm going to be institutionalized if I keep with that sport. But St. Thomas More's name was not used casually, I suspect, to ascribe a certain implicit Catholic character to these institutions' founding. So here we go, our Call Me Catholic Countdown of the week.
The Call Me Catholic Countdown.
We have our soothing Call Me Catholic Countdown.
It's our smooth jazz.
Okay, so these are my top five institutions named for the great St. Thomas More. Number five is going to be the Thomas More Building at the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand in London. It's an 11-story office block that was built in 1990 containing the courts of the Chancery Division of the High Court of Justice. And these are known as the Thomas More Courts.
Wow.
Now, I think this is just brilliantly ironic that here in the place of his beheading that was ordered by the King of England, King Henry VIII, they are now naming courts and buildings after Thomas More. They're not calling it the St. Thomas More Building, but they're calling it the Thomas More Building. Now, on the contrary, King Henry VIII, I think, has a bunch of pubs named after him. And probably some wedding chapels.
The definition of irony, right?
That is the definition of irony. Okay, number four is the St. Thomas More Hospital, located in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains at the entrance of the Royal Gorge in Colorado. We have some guests today in our studio,
That's
your aunt
right.
and uncle from Colorado.
Right.
So I put that in there in your honor. It's a nonprofit, faith-based hospital for Colorado's Fremont County and its surrounding communities. It has emergency and acute care services. But it's kind of interesting because you don't normally associate healthcare with Thomas More. You associate academia and law. But, you know, he really was, we're going to find this out with our guest, he was really a very good civil servant. He had great care for the poor, for the needy, and a big heart for that. So I think it's lovely. And they actually put on their website, this is what they say, we are proud to have extended the healing ministry of Christ to the sick and injured in Fremont County for more than 75 years, a legacy we continue today. So good for you, St. Thomas More Hospital in Colorado, for giving Christ a shout out.
Beautiful.
St. Thomas More
Love
would
that.
Approve of that. Okay, number three would be the St. Thomas More Society of Boston College. Now, this is a student organization named after this English martyr, and they dedicate themselves to the heritage of the Catholic faith on campus. And I love this. In fact, in my research, I found out that a lot of student organizations, kind of the Newman Center type organizations on college campuses, call themselves the Thomas More Society.
That's right.
And I
yeah.
like this one at Boston College. They had a nice write up and they give a good shout out to the saint and give a little background and then say they want to carry on his legacy of learning and Catholic doctrine and his intellectual tradition. So good for you, Boston College. Okay. Number two is the Thomas More College in Crestview Hills, Kentucky. Thomas More College is a small liberal arts college and considered one of the best regional universities in the South. It was founded in 1921 by the Benedictine sisters. And here's what I liked about it. When you go on the site, really boldly, it says, do you want to become a saint? Well, it's cute because they name all their teams the Saints of Thomas More College, their basketball team, their, I don't know if they have a football team. I think they have a hockey team. So I like that. And they also, in their tabs, have a click for the namesake. So in other words, you want to know more about Thomas More. And so they didn't just casually ascribe that name to their college. They are taking responsibility for it and for the legacy that they are perpetuating with it, like that in Kentucky.
Good.
Okay, my number one will be the Thomas More Law Center. Now, this is a legal aid organization that provides litigation law services for those arguing conservative aligned issues, especially those dealing with religious liberty and expression. So it's based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I think they've been involved in some pretty high profile cases for religious liberty. I think they were part of the Terry Schiavo case.
Wow.
So they don't shy away from cases that require a lot of moral courage, and St. Thomas More would be very impressed with that. Okay, now I left out the out of this list. That's my top five, but I left out of this list the St. Thomas More Society for Lawyers, because our guest coming up is going to tell us all about that. Greg Weiler is one of the founding members and former presidents of the St. Thomas More Society of Orange County, a professional organization for lawyers, about 1,200 lawyers in all, wanting to align their legal practice with the standards of St. Thomas More. Greg's going to help us know and appreciate this 16th century English martyr a little bit better. Hey, maybe you have a devotion to St. Thomas More, or you're involved in an organization or an institution that's named after him. Well, by all means, give us a call and join this conversation by dialing 714-282-6034. That is 714-282-6034. Marvelous Matt, our call screener, will introduce himself and patch you through to our dialogue coming up in a little bit. You might have to be on hold, but you'll still be able to hear the conversation. And don't forget to check out our Facebook page and give us a like. You don't have to do that during the show. You can do that after the show, right?
Usually I say, give us a like if you are so inclined, so then it doesn't come across as we're begging for likes.
Yeah, we could get sued for that, right? Well, we've got an attorney right here. He's going to help us. We're honoring St. Thomas More today on Call Me Catholic. So near to his feast day. So stay with us as we learn more about this compelling saint and martyr from our ever-rich church history. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Celebrating, exploring, and restoring our Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hi there, and welcome back to this scholarly edition of Call Me Catholic. I'm Peggy Normandin, and today we are honoring the life and legacy of St. Thomas More, whose feast day on some calendars is tomorrow, July 9th, and on other calendars, more modern calendars, it was on June 22nd, but that's irrelevant. He is, after all, a man for all seasons, a classical scholar, a humanist, a statesman, a politician, a man of prayer, the author of the famed Utopia, a theologian, and a lawyer by profession. He was Lord Chancellor to King Henry VIII, the man who ordered his execution in 1535 for denying the king his new title of Supreme Head of the Church in England. And we have an excellent student of St. Thomas More with us in the studio today to further enlighten us on this deep subject. Greg Weiler is a practicing attorney here in Southern California in Orange County, and as such, he has adopted as his patron the great martyr, St. Thomas More. Greg has used Thomas More as a model for his Catholic activism. He is a strong advocate for the rights of the unborn, and he is a founding member and former president of the St. Thomas More Society of Orange County, a nonprofit professional association consisting of more than 1,200 lawyers and judges dedicated to bringing Catholic Christian ethics to the legal profession. Greg, welcome to Call Me Catholic.
Thank you, Peggy.
Hey, now, on a personal note, I have to say that in your bio, as I was reading your bio, I really zeroed in on this really cute little personal statement that he said, that in his epitaph, he would like it to say on his tombstone, "Here lies the father of three Eagle Scouts."
Ah.
That's pretty awesome. Now, do you have more children than that and only three made it to Eagle Scouts?
No, the oldest is a girl.
And, oh, okay.
So they wouldn't let her in back then.
Yeah.
But at that time of my life, which probably ended 10 years ago, it was an integral part. And I loved the Boy Scouts. They followed in the footsteps of St. Thomas also.
Well, yeah, I will just go one step further and say that in modern times, Boy Scouts, its time is now, because it gives the boys back to the earth, you know, to their organic engagements with things that have dirt and scales and creepy crawly things. So I love the Boy Scouts too.
St. Thomas More would love the Scout Law.
What is the Scout Law?
Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, brave, clean, and reverent.
Spoken as a true father of three Eagle Scouts. So how do you think St. Thomas More would like to be remembered today? You would like to be remembered as the father of three Eagle Scouts. What do you think he'd like to be remembered as?
Well, I probably want to amend mine to be the same as St. Thomas, but I think he would definitely, in all humility, point to fidelity to the truth in the face of overwhelming odds, the one person who would stand against even the realm, even the monarch of the British Empire at that point, fidelity. He always stressed faith throughout his life, and the theme will go from the beginning of his life to the last moment on the scaffold.
When he said, I'm the king's servant, but I am first God's servant, something to that effect.
Very close.
Yeah. So for our listeners today, we're going to have a little lesson in St. Thomas More, because we can all maybe picture him, that Hans Holbein portrait that's so famous. That's, I saw it in the Frick Museum. It's awesome. It's office at Cromwell on the big doorpost.
Oh, yes.
But let's dig a little deeper. Let's kind of unpack this man, because he is known as a man for all seasons. Let's start with some of the basics of his life. He grew up in England, went to Oxford University. You take it from there.
Well, it's interesting to note, and we can summarize his life very quickly, but we got to hearken back to the beginning of the 16th century in Great Britain. It was a time, he was a contemporary of Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci in Italy. It was a time of great change. The printing press had just dawned. At the same time, you still read by candlelight. We had his time at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, and yet he was in England. At the time, England had a population, a great population of about 3 million people, about less than Orange County today. And London was a town of 50,000, maybe the same as San Juan Capistrano, where I live. So that was his milieu at that point. But he had a great father, a father who stressed education and sent him to the finest school in London. And thereafter, at the age 12, he became page to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then thereafter, he left his dad. The Archbishop thought he was so great, he sent him off to Oxford. His dad put up with that for 2 years, but then was worried he wasn't going to have a practical education, brought him back to study law. And that's where he got his legal education. Shortly thereafter, he was called to the bar. But during that time of education, he spent 5 years learning Latin and Greek. And during that period of time of reflection and education, during the time of 1500 to 1520, he became one of the greatest intellectual scholars in all of Europe, medieval Europe, with correspondence to all the great intellects. So that's Thomas More's youth before he was called to the crown.
But wasn't he also, didn't he consider the priesthood for a period of time?
Yes, he spent a lot of time discerning that. He struggled because he was such a passionate Catholic man. His dad raised him that way. That was a time when there was just the Catholic Church. And he spent a long time during his studies living next to a Carthusian monastery and became a monastic in the sense of his spiritual exercises. But he elected to be a chaste husband rather than an unfaithful cleric. And that was his choice. And that was the words his son-in-law used. And he got married to his first wife and had their children, a boy and 4 girls. Yeah.
And then his wife, he became a widow.
3 girls. Yes.
And he remarried. And did he have any more children after that?
No. He married Alice, the Alice you see in A Man for All Seasons, which I think is very close depiction of the way she really was.
Strong woman.
Strong woman. And he raised her 2 stepchildren, too.
Well, yes, I heard that while he was raising his 4 children, that he also took in other children, other people that needed some parenting.
Yes,
we've all known those children.
I'm not sure how he took in some of the other children, but he did. And the whole family was integrated. And you'll see him in the picture. And he and the whole family followed forth in his spiritual exercises, daily exercises of his spiritual life, his prayer life.
Give us an example of the family devotions, because I think it's so fascinating that it was so authentic. There was no affectation to this. He just incorporated spirituality into their life as you would nourishment and exercise. It was essential and very natural.
It was integral to the man, much like Vatican II urged us, the universal call to holiness. Well, he adopted it 500 years earlier. He would get up early every morning. He would have private meditation, private prayer, and then the Mass. But what fascinates me most, maybe as I get older, and I love the Psalms, he knew the Psalms backwards and forwards. He had 7 favorite penitential Psalms. I thought it fascinating. One of the holiest men in the Renaissance era focused on the penitential Psalms. Then he would have his family recite 3 Psalms, and they'd do their devotion. So this is a man of the Psalms, fascinates me. And then a man of the Mass and the liturgy. They have Mass every morning when there was a priest available. So he was a Eucharistic man. There's not a lot written about that, but since he was a devotee of the Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, the last part of that book written about 75 years before he was born, was one of his favorite books. So we know he was a Eucharistic man also.
He was an authentic man of God, and he didn't take it casually. I'm talking today with attorney and scholar Greg Wiley. You know, he said he's a student. I'm promoting him to scholar, Jimmy G. I could listen to him talk forever. Greg Wiley, he founded the St. Thomas More Society of Orange County and has long held the saint in high esteem as a model for his personal and professional life. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a comment, this is the time to ask a question about St. Thomas More. Give us a call at 714-282-6034. That's 714-282-6034. We have not had too many scholars in with such a great depth and passion for the subject as we
I just thought of a great idea. We should begin issuing honorary Call Me Catholic degrees.
Here we go.
To our special guests.
Yeah.
We'll have them printed up really nice.
Uh-huh.
Suitable for framing.
Right. You've just, our conversation just got downgraded a huge amount.
With the tuition, oh my goodness.
No, okay, now we're going to come at it with an angle. Let's talk, you made reference to the movie Man for All Seasons, which is what a lot of people know of St. Thomas More. Do you think, now this is, of course, based on the play by Robert Bolt, and then it became the great movie with Paul Scofield in the 1960s. Do you think that's an authentic portrayal of him?
I must say, having read the only contemporary biography by his son-in-law, William Roper, that I'm just amazed at how true the screenplay is to
the story,
the true
and
story
the
given by his son-in-law. Now, you know, albeit he's got to be somewhat biased for his father-in-law, but it's amazing. There's a few a little poetic license here and there, but the portrayal in the tower. His integrity in judging, his family life. I don't think it emphasized his spiritual life as much, but it was like breathing for him.
But you know what? It's very difficult to show a person's interior. I mean, that you just had to judge it by their actions. My favorite scene in that movie, Greg, is when King Henry VIII, portrayed by the great burly Robert Shaw, kind of comes to visit Thomas More and his family, and he's hoping to get him on his side with regards to his marriage to Anne Boleyn. And he kind of stomps out of the boat, his boots are all muddy, and he's very likable and affable, and the conversation, you know, Thomas More just holds his own. And you see there, that was difficult because this was a likable king. He was an king you could embrace and, you know, sort of have a beer with, but Thomas More held his own very, you know, rigidly.
No, he did, and that's a great scene, too. I think we're all looking at him, look at the mud. Who's going to clean all those clothes at that point?
He's a messy king.
And the fact that it was an impromptu get-together, but they all knew about it and spent all day getting ready for him, and poor Alice was there just wanting to please the king. And before he even went in for dinner, they had the big fight, and he stomped off, and he left everybody behind. It's a classic scene.
Well, he attributed his exit to the high tides, didn't
yes.
he? The tide is getting high. I must go.
Perfectly cast character with Robert Shaw before he started fishing for sharks.
Okay, so Greg, you also mentioned the scenes in the Tower of London, which are certainly grim depictions of his final days. Tell us the story about this prop that you brought with us today. I say prop rather disrespectfully, but tell us about that.
Yes, I call it my 20th class relic I brought from the Tower of London. We had occasion with Father Hugh Barber, one of my best friends and one of certainly our spiritual director for 20 years at the Thomas More Society. The reason that our Orange County Society even exists, and we went to visit the tomb of St. Thomas More on pilgrimage before we went to the Holy Land. And I had occasion to be in that the cell with Judge David Bells, one of our co-founders also. Mm-hmm. And we were there and we just spent quiet time in when all the other folks left and we were in there. And I looked down and it's very rough hewn floor in there, although much larger than you'd expect. And I picked up a piece of the wall. It was on the floor. And I looked at Father Hugh and said, Father, can I take this? And he goes, indeed, in the best tradition of Catholic pilgrims, take it. So I got it in here glued to a cross.
Yeah, yeah. I'll take a little picture of that and put it up on our Facebook page. Well, that must have been a very sobering moment when you lawyers and judges stood there in the Tower of London and came to kind of the reality of what this man faced. And, you know, his courage at the sticking post, you know, I mean, that was took an enormous amount of courage and moral integrity to just not cave against all the wishes of his family, kind of saying, just give in, just pledge your support of the king. You don't have to live by it. Just pledge it.
15 months he spent in the tower, and it's right off the Thames River. So in the windows, there are no windows except the slits for arrows,
yeah,
et cetera.
I didn't think there were any
windows. So the moist air would come in, and here's a man of 56, 57 years old, years I've just recently left. And it must have been very hard, but he was steadfast. And his spirituality, by the way, one thing that he emphasized in his writings, we can't really penetrate them, is he focused on the Passion of the Christ. Mm. And that was one of the steadfast sort of reboots that he would do the passion, and I'm sure he resorted to that in that. It was a rather large cell. He was a nobleman, and for a while before the king took away his books, he had some servants to help him, etc.
Wow, what a picture that is. We are speaking with attorney Greg Weiler, and we're going to continue our conversation about the great 16th century martyr, St. Thomas More. Greg's bringing some great dialogue and great insight into this conversation, his life, his legacy, especially as it relates to the legal profession. If you would like to join the conversation with a comment or question, give us a call. We have time, and we'd love to hear from you. The number is 714-282-6034. That's 714-282-6034. Or just stay with us, because we've got lots more interesting stuff to cover. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Helping you navigate the daily struggles and blessings of life. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello and welcome back to Call Me Catholic. I'm Peggy Normandin, and we're getting an academic look today at a fabulous saint. We're learning about the life and legacy of St. Thomas More. It's actually more interesting than academic. I mean, I'm making it sound like we're sitting in the classroom. No, this is a very, very, very animated conversation. Greg Weiler is leading our conversation. He's an Orange County attorney, a founding member of the St. Thomas More Society of Orange County, and he's been shedding some new light on this incredible hero of our faith. You know, Greg, I'd like to ask you what you think St. Thomas More, how he would feel about our Supreme Court justices.
I think St. Thomas would be not pleased with our current justices, because we remind him so much of the perversion of justice that we saw in his time that he fought so much against. But certainly I would love to have him advise our current justices. I think he would inform Justice Thomas. He would inform, he did inform the late Justice Antonin Scalia of fond memory. But more than anything else, I'd like him to inform the Catholic Justice Anthony Kennedy. I think he would, frankly, be appalled, but not quite surprised at the jurisprudence and philosophy of Justice Kennedy, because Justice Kennedy articulated much of the same humanism of his time. Humanism would focused on the human being, but completely detached from truth, a self-definition, a radical autonomy. And that's what our Catholic Chief Justice Anthony Kennedy promoted in the Casey case and those cases that allowed Roe v. Wade to go on. So I think he'd be deeply disappointed, and boy, do I think he could give him an earful on jurisprudence.
Well, I also want to point out that Antonin Scalia, Justice Antonin Scalia, God rest his wonderful soul, he might be up there with Thomas More right now, exchanging views on things, but he held Thomas More in great esteem. He had a portrait of him, the famous portrait of him, in his office. But this is what I loved about Justice Scalia. At the second inauguration of President Barack Obama, Justice Antonin Scalia wore that big black round hat that Thomas More is pictured in his famous portrait. And I loved that sort of subtle statement, because you couldn't help but draw the association there. But he held Thomas More in great esteem. I mean, he really drew inspiration from him.
Yes, Justice Scalia was the only justice of the Supreme Court that I personally met and had dialogue with on this on the jurisprudence of adjudicating our Constitution. And I found him fascinating, because I was mad at him for about 10 years because he spoke at Thomas Aquinas College and said that the Declaration principles of our Declaration of Independence were wholly apart from his jurisprudence. And I was outraged, saying, what about the natural law? Would you allow people to be put in concentration camps? So I put that question to him when we talked for only a few minutes, and I said, if we had a constitutional amendment that was properly adopted that said Jews and Catholics go to the concentration camp and are killed, you would uphold that as being consistent with the Constitution and the natural law? And he looked at me and straight in the eye, because he obviously thought about it at length, and said, I would either enforce that law or I would resign and join all the folks on the ramparts in revolt against that unjust and tyrannical government. So well, honest.
That's very much what Thomas More did. He resigned.
Exactly. He was not about to make up the law like so many of our justices do in the Supreme Court and politicize it. He would either enforce the laws adopted by the representatives or he would exercise his right in conscience.
That sounds like a pretty deep conversation to have in 2 minutes, Greg.
Well, it might have been a few more.
You lawyers really know how to size it up. Hey, we've got a caller. She's from Reno, Nevada. Patricia, you're listening to Call Me Catholic on EWTN Radio. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Did you have a question for our guest today?
Together. I do, yes. The question I have is, do you think with this new administration there's any hope for the Thomas More philosophy and their values to come back into our justice, Supreme Court, and why do you think there's so many people that fight the natural law that Thomas More spread?
Well, hope springs eternal. The voice is very familiar, but I'm certainly confident and optimistic because if you have men of goodwill, men that recognize that there is truth and we are grounded and we're not left to our own devices, and as long as people are involved in our government, then the United States government will continue. We had a 200-year history where we had majoritarian consensus on there was truth and we were tethered to it. But there is a vast movement going on, the secular humanism movement, to separate humanity in the search for meaning and truth from absolute truth. Some people want to say that the sun comes up in the west and rises in the east, but last I looked, it doesn't. And last I looked, if I throw my pen in the air, it still hits the ground. But there are people that say no to that. So we're fighting against it. It's a constant battle for our liberty, and that's what our founders knew. And we have to hope for men of integrity and hope for justices. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. All I care about is if you're a man of justice, and justice is a transcendent concept.
How does that do for you, Patricia?
That's great. I just want to know, how can someone as a practicing Catholic in the government also be pro-abortion? I mean, how can they be so blinded?
Well, I'm going to jump in there, Patricia, and say that is a subject for a different show. And it is difficult for those of us who are pro-life to acknowledge anyone, whether you're Catholic or not Catholic, not respecting the dignity of life from conception to natural death. And we know Thomas More certainly would have been at the forefront of that argument. But what's to become of Catholics in office who do not, who promote abortion or do not, defend the right? I don't think we are in a position to assess the consequences of that. But, you know, God himself will certainly judge that. But thank you for your call, Patricia. That was super.
Thank you.
You know, one thing, Greg, that I would also respond to, say, in a kind of a general sense, is that the art of discourse is lost today. Now, St. Thomas More had opinions, but he got along with everybody. And so did Justice Antonin Scalia. They knew how to, I mean, just as far as I remember, Justice Antonin Scalia and Ruth Ginsburg were grand friends, family friends, and yet they stood vastly in different poles of opinions about the law. But I think we've lost our civility in these things. And so as a result, we're not learning. We're sort of shutting down the channels of learning through discourse.
No, and one thing we would be remiss in talking about St. Thomas if we didn't talk about him as the man and how attractive he was. He was a man of great, great humor and great empathy. And he could joke around with anybody. He could certainly be on the Supreme Court, and he would certainly rib Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But they could, they could be together and laugh about what they knew is true. And if you're a man of goodwill and you look at the other person as a child of God, you're going to find that person attractive, and you're going to lead him to truth. And he spent his entire life first leading his family, and then his friends, and then his country to truth because he cared. He loved them. If you love somebody, you don't let them jump off a cliff.
Yeah.
That's what he did his entire life, right up to the scaffold.
Amazing. Now, before we get into a little thing I want to do with St. Thomas More quotes, I also want to hear a little bit more about the St. Thomas More Society of Orange County, because I'm sure there are attorneys out there in different parts of the country that are thinking, I'd like to affiliate with that if there's one in my area, or I'd like to start one if there isn't one.
It's amazing to me how many Catholic lawyers there are in Orange County, let alone the country, that don't know anything about us. But our little group of merry men and women were founded in 1994. All three of us, the founders, had recently attended a Curcio Week and a wonderful retreat that is intended to to light the fire of your faith and a 3-day
and
retreat.
And sustain it. Keep it.
Oh,
keep
gosh. It and to fire it up. So do a crusade. A first recommendation if you're a Catholic lawyer and you're trying to survive this crazy profession that we're in is do a crusade. And then we associated, and our whole goal, led by Father Hugh Barber, a wonderful Norbertine.
One of the most plugging Father Hugh Barber.
Oh, he's one of the most brilliant men
he
in the
church.
He is
brilliant.
Today.
I know him and I love him. And he actually referred me to you. So God bless him for
and,
that.
And, but brilliance untethered to holiness, I don't need too much of that.
Ah, very important distinction.
But he is so holy, like, yeah. Father Leo, the Norbertine. But so many, we're blessed with so many wonderful priests in this diocese and throughout the church. But we get together, our whole goal was to evangelize a profession, to lead them to Christ, because so many lawyers are notoriously unhappy. They spend all their time
thinking. I thought dentists were the unhappy profession.
Oh, they look in mouths, but these poor lawyers look at money and hours, yeah. And they're always tempted. They work too hard, and they have to bill hours, and they're always thinking about money. Mm. So they end up working too hard, or they end up fudging their hours. Either one are pernicious. So what we hold out to them is a better way, a more perfect way. And that's what we do consistently, a more perfect way. And there's a methodology to it. And the methodology was given to us first by our Lord and the apostles, but also by St. Thomas More. A prayer life, meditation, quiet time. If you love somebody, you got to spend time with them. If you want to learn about somebody, you got to spend time with them. And that's what we promote. Monthly programs.
Well, and the fellowship, the collegiism of being able to talk through a problem, say, hey, I'm struggling with this, because sometimes the answer or the decision, the action you should take doesn't come clearly right away. You need to talk to someone who shares like values, who understands the truth the way you do.
And the modern law firms are much more secular now than they were 20, 30 years ago when I first started. You could debate pro-life issues and traditional value issues 30 years ago. Now, you risk being ostracized. There is a cost of discipleship, but it's a wonderful thing, the paradox. The cost of discipleship that St. Thomas paid was so worth it. Who knows Cromwell now?
Yeah.
Who, right. 500 years later, we're looking at Thomas More being at the, well.
He's got these buildings named after him in Parliament or right on the Strand in London.
G.K. Chesterton said 100 years ago, he said, he's more needed now than at the time of his death. And he'll be needed more 100 years from now, which is almost now.
Well, I love that we can be talking about this and keeping his legacy alive and teaching people about what we have to learn from him. But I'm going to take a quick break, and I want to ask you something. How do you think Thomas More got his news, Greg? Where do you think he got his daily news, his information about what was going on in the world around him?
Interesting time, because there was no media. The printing press had just been invented. Most of it was correspondence. He corresponded with Erasmus, the great humanist, Christian humanist of his day, corresponded with all the intellectuals. The Protestant Reformation was just being formed, but letters and then rumor from the court.
Okay. It's fake news.
Fake news.
Well, I think it's important for Catholics to have a solid resource for reading honest Catholic news. And the Catholic News Agency, known as CNA, is really the only fast, reliable, and free Catholic news source that brings blogs and stories, editorials, and photos right to your fingertips. It's an online news feed that has up-to-the-minute articles and information about Catholic current events. And if you're Catholic, you should be staying up with Catholic current events. You can access it by going to CatholicNewsAgency.com. That's CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's just another terrific service from EWTN News. Hey, Greg, did you like how I kind of smoothed into that little promo?
You're clever.
Okay. I want to now do a little something with you. I went online and found some great quotes from St. Thomas More. And I'd like to throw out that quote, and then I'd like to hear you respond to it. In other words, tell us if you think this gives us a little window into what Thomas More was like, or how it is applicable to today. Okay?
Sure.
So here's one that I liked. He says, one of the greatest problems of our time is that many are schooled, but few are educated. Thomas More's words.
Well, he had a classic education. He was a Renaissance man, so he studied the ancients, the pagans, but he did it from a Christian point of view, and went to Christian Catholic schools. They were all the schools were Catholic. There was no distinction then. And I think it was an education grounded on truth. You can look at the prism, but if not looking to truth, we know the way the truth and the life is. So I think that's what he was talking about. It goes back to one of the, and we'll get to it, but maybe we won't. But when he said to Cromwell after he was unceremoniously kicked out, that famous statement that is the bedrock of my personal philosophy is you don't do what you can do. You do what you should do. The legal profession today, the lawyer, I just had a horrible example last week of a lawyer. He did what he could do instead of what he should do. And that's why their lawyer jokes were dead. maybe there won't be.
I didn't put any into our script today, Greg.
Well, you know, you note that St. John Paul the Great, before that time when we were kids, there were Polish jokes everywhere. There are no more Polish jokes.
Hey, well, and I'm not going to even mention blonde jokes. Okay.
And I'm so interesting, too, when you said did what he could do instead of what he should do. That's a very interesting distinction.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes you think, well, this is my strength. I'm going to go here instead of taking the harder route. But, you know, another point about the education is that he was very progressive about education for women. So his daughters received a better education than a lot of other young men in England at the time.
You mentioned Margaret at the beginning. I'm glad we got back to her. His daughter Meg.
Had a very tender relationship with her.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's my favorite stories. But he educated all his girls with a classical education. Mm-hmm. He was a classic first feminist, the true feminism. But he trained them in the classics. They knew Latin, some Greek. They had much better education than I'm sure most of us have had.
Yeah.
And he didn't distinguish between men and women. At the same time, he'd laughed. He was a realist. He knew there was a distinction between men and women. And like today, where we just say there's not, he would kid about his wife. He would kid about Alice talking too much. And we've all know that there's a difference between men and women.
Youngman, right? Yes. There is the
but it's so great. But his sense of humor and goodwill, you can be humorous and note distinctions if you have a man to go. But he loved his daughters and Meg. The day he died, she went to him and she threw himself around his neck and she cried and cried. And this is something we can talk about, her trying to persuade him to take the oath. And then she said her goodbye and he was kind and it was a moment. And then later, he's walking to the scaffold. She ran up through the guards and the swords and the pikes and threw arms around him again. It was two or three times and she just
must have just been heart-wrenching to witness
goodness,
that
for both.
Yeah. Okay. So wonderful. Thank you for expounding on that. Now, here's another quote. He said, "The things we pray for, good Lord, give us grace to labor for."
He was a huge proponent. At the time, there was a very dangerous concept brought by Luther that said the will, it's not the will, it's faith alone. The will. Sure. There's no concept
of merit. We're still hearing some of that today.
And there's no concept of merit. And it's just a conundrum because we know it's all grace. Mm-hmm. But the good Lord gives us a gift of participating. Well, that's the concept that he's talking about. You need to labor for it. He's not a proponent of the little way of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, which we were graced with 400 years later, but he knew that you had to be intentional on your faith. And what could you do? How can you be intentional? Service to the poor, a prayer life. You got to have conversation with the good Lord, and you got to educate your family and evangelize others and give them the gift of the faith. What greater gift are you going to give them? Gold? So he was intentional, and that takes an act of the will and effort.
Yeah, and hard work. I mean, he worked very hard. He was not a man of leisure. Okay, here's another one. Time trieth truth. His life is a good example of that right there, right?
Well, absolutely. I assume that I don't know the context, but I assume it meant that you look at things with the breadth of years, and certainly his life is his best testament. I look at the people that talk about St. Thomas More, all the Wolf Hall folks that talk about, he was a bad guy.
Yeah, well, I was going to get into that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I look at it, and Albert Schweitzer, the great 20th century doctor, said, "My life is my argument." Well, I'll put St. Thomas's life against any contemporary life, Henry VIII, Cromwell's, all the other folks that were not faithful. And his philosophy, his faith stands the test of time.
And we haven't learned any from, Cromwell. Do you have Cromwell being taught in law school? I mean, is there a King Henry VIII model of behavior? No, not at all. Okay, so we have another call from Carol in Wisconsin, who's listening to EWTN on WSFI radio. Welcome to Call Me Catholic, Carol.
Yes, good morning. What a fantastic show. I'm getting so much out of it.
Me too.
And, it certainly is an invitation for more study and prayer on St. Thomas. My question was there a miracle attributed to him to become a saint, or did they not need them at that time?
Hi, Carol. I don't know if there was I think it was 1935. He was beatified by Pope Leo, one of my favorite popes, in the late 19th century, and canonized along with Bishop John Fisher in 1935.
Well, who was killed, martyred just before him.
Just before him. Another great story. When all the bishops of England left the church, one was faithful, John Fisher, a wonderful guy, and friend and contemporary of St. Thomas's. I don't know if there were miracles attributed to him in 1935, but it was no accident the timing of the canonization, the rise of the Third Reich, the same kind of tyrannical government, unsevered, a radical utilitarian fascism taking over, that the church in its beautiful infinite wisdom decided to give us a couple of models for fidelity to the truth.
Wow. That was
very good.
Yeah. And you know what, Carol? I also think sometimes a person's virtue plays out in their enduring legacy. So like we've been saying, you know, who remembers Cromwell or holds him up as a model for anything? But St. Thomas More has law schools, hospitals, buildings in London named after him, which certainly attest to, that's kind of a miracle in itself, right?
Peggy, you know the miracle that you talked about, the irony? You know, on the list of Anglican martyrs, St. Thomas More is listed.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Everybody wants a piece of him.
Yes. Even the church that was founded based upon the actions of a tyrant named him as a
the
as
very
a
thing he was beheaded for. Yes. That's fascinating. Well, Carol, thank you for your good question, and thanks for listening to Call Me Catholic. As a matter of note, I always think it's interesting to know what miracles were attributed to different saints, because that's not always publicized, but I think it's absolutely fascinating. So Thanks for that. I'm going to go home and look that up.
Yeah, Jim, get on the Google.
He's our chief fact checker. Thanks, Carol. Call back again,
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, so I'm going to go to another quote. This one I really like. This is a little bit longer. So he says, this is Thomas More speaking, and he says, Aesop says in a fable that everyone carries a double wallet on his shoulders, and into the one that hangs at his breast he puts another's folks' faults, and he looks and pores over it again and again. In the other, he puts all his own and swings it at his back, which he never likes to look at, although others that come behind him cast an eye into it sometimes. So I think that's it's kind of interesting. It's cool.
He was a student of human nature, and he knew so much, especially in himself. He, like I said, on the penitential rites, he knew he was a sinner, and he noted his faults. This is remember, a century before St. Ignatius and the examine, where you examine your conscience, he well knew and held his weaknesses up, especially pride. He was so vigilant against personal pride. Here's a man, most brilliant intellect probably in the world, and a statesman, a lawyer, a judge, a member of parliament, speaker of the parliament, and then chancellor of all the realm. And he thought he knew his limitations and everything was a gift of God. Amazing man.
Well, and in reading some of his letters, he was somewhat self-deprecating, too. He never felt he was a very worthy servant.
He was deprecating himself, and that allowed him to cheerfully and in a fun way tease other people. Our faults are there. We're human beings.
Yeah. Okay. So here's another quote of his. He says, "It is part of the business of life to be affable and pleasing to those whom either nature, chance, or circumstances has made our companions." And we kind of touched on that a little bit.
Yeah, we all know you can't evangelize unless you're joyful, and you're only joyful if you know why you're rejoicing. It's called the good news. And if you look at a sourpuss Catholic or Christian, they're not going to evangelize anybody, and it's no fun either. And he liked to have fun.
Well, so this is such a documented aspect of his personality. Why? And I didn't really want to get into this, but why in the Wolf Hall depiction of Thomas More is he kind of irascible, and he wasn't in none of that?
Well, I think the answer to your own question, if you're a modern producer in Hollywood and you hate the concept of truth and you hate the concept of goodness, how are you going to depict the man who epitomizes the very things you despise? If you're a person, and we don't need to get into the political issues, but the answer to the question is...
We kind of already have.
Well, the goodness, as Francis Thompson says in A Hound of Heaven, it's traitorous trueness. If you're not true yourself, you're going to depict that man in a very bad way. And that depiction, I didn't watch it, except I boned up for your show because you asked me. And I can tell you the depiction in Wolf Hall is far from the truth.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, there was also a TV version of Man for All Seasons, which Charlton Heston played. And I think it was on TNT, and it did not endure. Why would you remake a Man for All Seasons, you know, with Paul Scofield, Orson Welles, don't go there.
Well, they just did Ben-Hur again, too. But you point out a great fact. Hollywood, it was just before the deluge in the mid-late 60s. We'd have Ben-Hur. We had the greatest epics in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and you never see those now. You wouldn't see the Ten Commandments. You wouldn't see these these icons that you and I were raised with that bolstered our faith. Now I have to try to force my grandchildren to watch these movies, and they're so used to instant gratification from video games that I can't. But I know that our friends at Dynamic Catholic are working on that. They've got some great
Matthew
animation.
Matthew Kelly. He's good. He's got a good sense of it. And a lot of people that are art critics would say they're going at these things with too much of an agenda. You have to go at it as a work of art, as a work of truth, and let the story tell itself instead of kind of hammering with an agenda. You know, we're kind of beginning to approach the end of our hour, Greg, which is not nearly enough. We've only scratched the surface of this subject only because you have such an incredible wellspring of knowledge there. What would you tell our listeners, like Carol, who was just kind of on fire with the subject because of all the information you shared with us? How would you advise them to go about learning about? How did you learn about? How did you begin this devotion and teach yourself about St. Thomas More?
Well, the biographies are out there, and you've got to be careful because, again, everybody's got an agenda. But I'd start with Jerry Wegemer's A Portrait of Courage. It was the first biography that I ever read. He's got an incredible biography to it, and it will open you up. Then I'd read William Roper's a little tougher biography of his father-in-law and start with that. And more than anything else, I get to learn the man. We always tend to want to make our Lord an abstraction. And we make St. Thomas an abstraction. Mm-hmm. We need to make them a reality.
They were people. Yeah.
And jovial people. The Christ was happy because he brought the good news. St. Thomas was happy because he knew the good news. But he knew the cost of discipleship. And he knew the fidelity always bore its cross. And he focused on the passion of Christ. So no matter what happened, he could bear it because he knew our Lord did. And by the grace of God, we can.
Yeah. Greg Weiler, this has been fabulously fascinating. And we love having guests that have so much knowledge and so much animation and energy and passion for their subject. We thank you so much for bringing so much enlightenment to this subject about St. Thomas More. He deserves great followers like you that will continue to evangelize the good news.
Thank you, Peggy.
We wish you continued luck with your St. Thomas More Society of Orange County. And look into that yourselves, folks, if you want to see if there's a legal association like St. Thomas More for your professional group. Certainly a lot to draw from. I also want to remind you that coming up in EWTN's radio programming today, we got lots of good shows. Barbara McGuigan and The Good Fight follows me. She's got 2 hours of excellent conversation on pro-life matters. But mostly we want you to tune in again next week, same day, same time, for more good news. Until then, my friends, I am Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic.
You've been listening to Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin, live from the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, California. Call Me Catholic is a co-production of EWTN Radio and Orange County Catholic Radio. Heard weekly on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.